Hello and welcome to the Care Exchange, Skills for Care podcast for managers and social care. I'm Pierre F. Day Burton.
And I'm Wendy Adams. Today we're talking to Isabel Delahaye, who is a solicitor who works within the health and social care team at the law firm Lester Aldridge. She qualified as a solicitor earlier this year. Prior to starting training as a solicitor, Isabel was the managing director of a nursing home in Wiltshire, and she's also a board member of the Local Care Association, which she has been for 7 years.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking to Isabel about her journey. It'll be really interesting to hear her perception of the sector from a legal perspective now. Just to be aware that we are talking to Isabel about the CQC Single Assessment Framework. The guidance and information from CQC are continually being updated while they are introducing the new framework. So just be aware that everything we talk to Isabel about is correct as of end of March 2024. So we really hope you enjoy this episode and on with the show. So welcome to the Care Exchange, Isabel.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. I'm really intrigued to talk to you. So, you know, and I think the first thing, just hearing the introduction, I wanted to ask you about was, so we heard that you qualified as a solicitor earlier this year. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So that's quite a career change from being a managing director of a nursing home. Why did you make that change?
After we had sold the nursing home business, my husband said to me, what now? What next? And because all the way through the sale process, I had not wanted to think about what came after because I wanted to remain focused on still operating the business to the best of my ability. And he said, if I had my time again, what would I do? And I said, well, I'd already always wanted to be a lawyer. And so he said, well, have you looked into it? And I said, no. So I then went and did some research, and they had just brought out a new route to qualification called the Solicitors Qualifying Examinations, the SQE. And suddenly the route to entry had changed and was an opportunity for me. And never being one to shy away from a challenge, I made some inquiries and decided that I wanted to go for it. And why not?
Wow.
Excellent. And I was just going to say, are there any similarities between working in the legal profession and working in social care then? What have you noticed that's similar?
People. It's really important to have that relationship with people that's appropriate. And also, I'm very mindful, because I work in health and social care in terms of the law, that I bring with me the history of having walked in those shoes.
Yeah.
So when we're having a conversation about an inquest and we're discussing with witnesses, perhaps it's, you know, been a difficult situation for them, and they are recounting what happened, the events, it can be distressing. And I have been in situations where I understand how distressing it can be when somebody cared for a long time has passed away.
Yeah.
And for our clients that don't have to explain what that feels like, I think it adds value to them.
Yeah, no, sure. So let's talk a little bit about that, you know, what you're seeing and what you've sort of kind of learned. So are they sort of things that you, with your now new knowledge, you think, God, I wish I'd known that when I was working in the sector, when I was a managing director of a nursing home?
Understanding the context of your role in the bigger picture. How does your service fit in with your local area, with the ICB, with the local authority? And really recognising the value and the part you play in a bigger wheel. The importance of being able to appropriately influence that and drive the change for, you know, from a business perspective, what's coming next, what's the direction of travel, how should I develop my service, how innovative should I be, can I be, is there a market for this? Having the opportunity now to reflect, whereas when you're operating, it can be very hard to have the opportunity to step back, to reflect, to pause, because I always used to say, it's not as if we can close it. It's not a corner shop and you can close it and do a stock take.
Yeah.
It's 24/7, 365 days a year. as everyone knows.
And what are the things that you think that you're kind of observing that people could do to make those, influence and being part of integration, I suppose?
Think the role of the care associations has certainly always been important, but I think during COVID, the role that they played increased exponentially. And that there's the support of peers when you're involved with the care associations, but they're also being used as a filter for information now, from central outwards. And also for funding, so things like digital social care, often that's being routed via the care associations. So I think actually, not being an island, and working with the competition as opposed to against the competition, and understanding that there's enough of a market there for a lot of providers for a long time.
Absolutely. And is there anything you wish you hadn't learned?
I wish I hadn't learned.
Is there anything you think, gosh, I wish I didn't know that now?
Gosh, that's a question. I think all knowledge is valuable. There's some things I wouldn't like to repeat. But yeah, I think it really does all represent a learning opportunity. And unfortunately, often you learn more from when things didn't go quite as planned than you do when you planned it all and it went swimmingly. And I think especially in health and social care, you're working with people and often with people who have additional needs, and therefore you have to be able to think slightly outside the box. And that's okay.
Absolutely.
This thinking outside the box and looking outward is really interesting, isn't it? Because I think when you're in it and you're doing that managing director or that registered manager role, you get very immersed, don't you, in the needs of the people that you're providing care and support to and the day-to-day running. And I think it is difficult for registered managers or managing directors or people to look more externally. I mean, you've talked a little bit about linking in with that wider context and care associations and the ICB. But are there other groups of people that you think, oh, I wish I'd built better relationships with them?
When we operated, we reached out to the local schools and colleges to look at the next generation of the workforce, also to demystify health and social care. We did some intergenerational projects with the local school as well. Trying those sorts of outreach opportunities can bring relationships that you didn't realize would represent an opportunity. Bringing the local primary school in every year, we were their rehearsal space for their Christmas carols, and the opportunity to do that sort of thing, then you're not just the property on the hill that houses the elderly people. For example, you're part of your community. Those special relationships with the pharmacy, so that when you are desperate for medication for a particular person who just had admitted and for whatever reason their medication hasn't come with them, to be able to turn around, really quick prescriptions. And relationships with the general practitioners are absolutely invaluable. And so much of health and social care is about relationships and about systems, and understanding how that works is crucial.
It's really interesting what you're saying about, working with the local schools and almost encouraging the next generation of social care workers. Because I think, often people don't see social care as being a career. They don't see that those opportunities. And actually, your career path then is a really great example of what could be done. Coming into social care and then going into something that is still social care but not necessarily directly social care. Was that career path something that you really championed with your staff when you were the managing director?
It was very important to me to identify people who perhaps didn't have the opportunity when they were at school and had untapped personal qualities that, if they were channeled in the right way, would represent an opportunity to both them, but also to us. It was often better, not always better, but often better to assist and develop people that were already in your workforce than to try and necessarily just look for somebody who had the specific qualification that you're looking for. So we worked with a couple of members of staff to become nursing associates as part of the first cohort of nursing associates. And that was a great opportunity. That was a huge learning experience for us. But yeah, that also represented working with the system again and navigating that was a challenge at times. But it represented an opportunity for both our service, but specifically also for those individuals who are now badged up, and that's their own achievement.
A nursing associate is a really great opportunity, isn't it? Because individuals who perhaps had aspirations to train as a nurse but didn't have the opportunity, this doing it as an apprenticeship, working, being paid, being supported by an employer is a really great way for people to get a profession, isn't it?
And reflecting on that now, both of those candidates were people who had come to that slightly later in their career path and went for it. And, perhaps looking back now, actually, maybe that also encouraged me to think, yeah, let's give it
Possibly.
a go.
You can do anything.
But also, I think the likes of the nursing associate role is a great example because I think there are a lot of people in the workforce who do want to progress but don't necessarily want to be manager. And I think historically that has been the main route in which you progressed. And I think a lot of people have a career path sort of like myself, when you speak to registered managers, what they'll often say is, well, I started as a care worker, I then became the senior care worker, I became the deputy, and then I became a manager. But actually, what are those opportunities for people if they don't want to be a manager, but actually they want to develop their skills and knowledge beyond that care worker, that care worker role? And I think that's great what you're talking about those two candidates for the nursing associate. I think it would be a really interesting thing to do to have those discussions with your existing staff about what would, exactly what somebody said to you. What would you really have liked to do?
Yeah,
If
you could.
if you could start again in
Yeah.
your career, in your life, what is it you'd really like to do? Because actually having those conversations with your existing staff might give you some real tips about what people want to do to develop. Because if somebody says, oh, well, actually, I'd have really loved to be a nurse, or I'd have really loved to be a physiotherapist, then actually that might give you a little bit of a clue about how to support them in their learning and development, because clearly they've got an angle towards medical stuff, haven't they? So you might think, well, actually, could we make a champion for for some of our health activity work, or is there an opportunity for nursing associate? So I love that question, that, and I know that your circumstances were, this was almost, right, okay, I'm now not doing that, and I have to have that conversation about what else would I have wanted to do. But actually, it's a really good conversation to have with staff, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
It also represents an opportunity for you as a provider, when you've had those conversations with staff, to really plan for the future and to delegate tasks to people, to give them the opportunity to take on more responsibility, to see if they are they have the personality to be committed to something new, something in addition. Because take on becoming a nursing associate, for example, when you are a carer or senior carer, is no mean feat. And the degree level work that's required, the work, the university that's required, can be quite daunting, the classroom environment, and someone that they might not have been in for a long time. So yeah, it's an opportunity on both sides.
Just going back to just thinking about you working as solicitor and obviously having clients, social care providers who are clients, are they sort of things that you think, gosh, I wish I'm surprised people don't take this more seriously, or I don't think people realise the risk they are putting themselves into? Are there things that sort of kind of really sort of stands out for you in terms of your the what you're seeing that your clients are doing or not doing?
the old adage of if it's not written down, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And now if it's not typed in, in a lot of circumstances, the ability with digital systems to evidence can be broader. So things are time stamped, for example, whereas people don't necessarily write the time that they wrote something down when they wrote it down physically. You can interrogate computer systems in a different way to you can interrogate written records. I think primarily the factual accuracy check process, I think people underestimate quite how significant a first step that process is after a CQC inspection. The provider is presented with a draft report to review, and the factual accuracy process is a process that is then underway. And often there's relief that it's over, it's done. The draft report reads well enough. I disagree, but I don't disagree too much. I don't want to upset CQC. I have a good relationship with my inspector, all of those sorts of things. The factual accuracy process represents another opportunity which we often see providers miss. That would be an opportunity not only to correct factually inaccurate information, but specifically to show CQC where the evidence that they've used to come to their judgments is incomplete. And if providers took that opportunity more frequently, more readily, their report may, if CQC agrees, read in a more rounded, more holistic, more reflective of their service, fairer, proportionate report than it otherwise would be. And we often speak to providers that then end up further down some kind of enforcement action that may comment, "Well, I never agreed with it anyway." And you think you missed an opportunity because by not challenging, even in a polite way, by not providing additional evidence, you are effectively saying, "I agree." So by default, and that's often an area I think, oh, I had not necessarily realized quite how important that was and what an opportunity that is for providers at the very beginning of the process, before it's made public, to say, "Okay, thank you, CQT, for what you said about my service, but I'd also like you to consider this evidence because you did look at these evidence categories and actually perhaps you missed these things."
And how do people, because I know you said why you think people maybe don't do that, and that's that overriding relief of, well, it's all over with. I don't necessarily agree, but I don't really want to drag this out any this torture out any longer. And that's why people maybe don't do it. But how do people do that?
So, under the new system, they will be sent a draft report, and then they will be invited to make three types of correction. One is a typographical or numerical. Something could be relatively minor, but for example, if it says that you have 100 residents and you've only got 10, that could be quite significant. Correcting job titles, things like that. And things like that are important to people. Secondly, is information that has contributed to CQC's judgment, but that the service believes is factually inaccurate. That can be perhaps in the way that the inspector appears to have, or the assessor appears to have read your information. They have misunderstood why you are recording it in that sort of way. And that's not necessarily a fault thing, it's just that it's been read. Two people could read the same thing in completely different ways. And the provider then has the opportunity to give additional supporting evidence, but it has to relate to the position at the time that the assessment was actually done. And the third thing is additional information, and this is the bit that normally gets missed, or information that was omitted, which the provider considers that CQC should look at. So that's a massive opportunity, but it's also a big piece of work because you've got to look at what you had at the time. Look at what CQC has said about your service and play spot the gap. And then provide that to CQC in the manner that CQC asks for it, which is usually electronic. And then sit back and wait and see what they say. And that, as you said, Wendy, sometimes you're just so relieved it's over. You don't want to have to do that.
No, but really
People
important.
can so people can submit additional evidence at that point, because I think that's maybe the bit that people don't realise is that if they see a gap, they can still at that point submit additional evidence.
Yes, so it's not evidence about everything. It's specific evidence about specific points that CQC have considered, and it's additional evidence that you think that they should consider when making a judgment about whatever it is they're making a judgment about.
And I suppose that's particularly important under the single assessment framework because, as it appears at the moment, they're only looking at a smaller number of quality statements. So therefore, it's really important that they're using the right evidence or judging the right evidence for those particular quality statements, because they're really, really important, aren't they? You know, that you
Absolutely. So there are 34 quality statements, five priority quality statements, and CQC announced by way of Ian Trenholme's blog that if you were requires improvement or inadequate in your previous rating overall, that CQC would now be looking at all of the quality statements under the key questions where you were rated as required improvement or inadequate, which is a massive change.
It is.
Because the providers that we've spoken to, the clients that we have, some of them had those ratings, and yet CQC only looked at 8 to 10 quality statements, which was insufficient to change their rating because it was mathematically not possible to do that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a big U-turn, isn't it? In many ways, and a welcome one. And I think interesting, because I think all the way through this process of change, with implementing the single assessment framework, CQC have said, you know, it's really, you know we're not always going to get it right, and we're really, you know, we really want to learn from the things that are not going well and listen to feedback and then make changes as we go. Providers that have been inspected so far have highlighted issues and then they've made changes. So I suppose that's a positive, isn't it?
It is. I think the single assessment framework broadly represents an opportunity for both CQC and for providers, and done well, I think it could be really, really good. And it is very encouraging that CQC are listening, on the basis that they are now committing to reviewing the quality statements under the key questions which affected people's overall rating by way of a limiter. I would be encouraged if the next step CQC took was to say, okay, well, we've now assessed this provider. They have a good rating, but we only chose to look at this handful of quality statements. But we recognize that one of their key questions still has evidence from perhaps 2019. I can think of one specific client whose well-led question remains at RI because the quality statements were not assessed as part of their SAF inspection. And so, whilst they are good overall, they still have an RI for well-led, but it reads as if it's been reviewed because the date on the CQC website now says updated, and yet that information is from years and years ago.
And the general public would never know that. The general public will look and
Everyone understands.
assume that if it was updated on such and such a date, that CQC have assessed everything.
It could certainly be made clearer when the information used for those scores hailed from. And I would assume CQT could do that by way of making a change to their system. But at the moment, that's not how it reads. And it certainly could be clearer.
So in terms of that single assessment framework, so obviously big change. We've been waiting for a long time, but still it's there. We have it now. What are the things that you, from a legal perspective, you think providers can do to prepare for upcoming inspections? Because they are different, aren't they?
They are different, yes. In terms of preparation, the first thing I would be saying is understand your current position. So look at your existing ratings for each key question and your overall rating, and consider in terms of the scoring where that means you are today before they even come. And therefore, you now get a hint. If you are RI or inadequate overall, they are going to look at the quality statements underneath those key questions.
Yeah.
So that's a big hint. You could now go and look at the quality statements. They will be assessing those. Look at also the priority quality statements, and then consider what evidence you have. What is it you would like to show the inspectors and the assessors when they ask for the information which you need to provide by way of evidence categories for each of those quality statements? And that's effectively a mapping exercise. It's saying, okay, this is my position as a service. Therefore, it's these key questions that I now know that they're going to look at. And therefore, these are the quality statements. And therefore, these are the evidence categories. And then almost inserting, making yourself a list or a spreadsheet of the evidence you're going to have. Because when they arrive, that's not the time you want to have to do that. You want to be ready.
Yeah.
And then it's also keeping that list up to date, because as your service evolves, you may have additional evidence that you'd like to show them. But once you have that going, then that would be a good place to start. Kind of 10, 15 years ago, we used to have a folder, the CQC folder, but obviously trying to promote digital, it would be wise to have that in an electronic fashion. And also some of that information you may be able to link to it from, say, an Excel spreadsheet. So if you've got policies that you'd like to be able to show, you can put the hyperlink to your policy, or drop it in as a pin, so that you can navigate to it straight away. Because when CQC start your assessment window, they will not only be potentially arriving at your door to look at your service and ask you to show them things there and then, but they will also be sending you an email from the assessor asking you for a list of information that they require to be sent back. And so you're managing two things simultaneously, which is a change for a provider.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose almost so you almost need to prepare yourself and your team for to expect inspection sounds dramatic, but that's almost what it is, because you have the assessor inspection, which is the person that's not in your service that you're sending stuff to, and then you've got the inspector inspection, the person that's in your service, talking to you, to your staff, to the people you're supporting, depending the type of service you are. So you almost need to almost have, I don't know, two spreadsheets or two tabs or something, where, with the quality, where are we going to get evidence in both incidents.
I think it's, as you say, Pia, really important to explain to your team that there is a change, and to get them used to, well, what is a quality statement? What is a we statement? Is that the same thing as a quality statement? What's an I statement? What's an evidence category? What does that look like? What does it look like for our service? So that when a CQC inspector is talking to members of staff, they are informed this new language is not a mystery. And that they feel empowered, because one of the most important things about your inspection, your assessment, is it could be seen as an opportunity rather than the day everyone fears, to show, actually, look, we've got this. This is what we do. This is our service. We're proud of it. And so often it doesn't feel that providers feel that they're empowered to do that.
Yeah, I get that.
And being ready is part of that journey, being, feeling that you have some control.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you think, so you talked about digital records and I think CQC is sort of kind of saying, we would appreciate that if all providers could be digital. And that's obviously for some services, that's quite a big thing. Are they things within that you think people should even to think about? I'm sort of thinking about the data security protection toolkit and the kind of safety of it from a legal perspective. Are things that providers need to be aware in terms of that?
So in terms of the Data Security Protection Toolkit, DSPT, it is very, very important that providers understand that that is an opportunity in terms of proving to oneself, and also being contractually compliant, that they keep data in a secure and appropriate way. And it's an online toolkit, and it's a self-assessment tool. and each provider has a unique code. It would be very important for each provider to ensure that it is standards met on the DSPT, and it would be very easy for an assessor to not have to visit a service but to use the internet, because it's freely available information, to see whether a provider is standards met. And we don't know yet how CQC is going to treat providers in terms of the quality statement under governance, which is part of well-led. Should they not be standards met, but one assumes it would likely be less than a three, which is a good. So that's an opportunity again for providers getting ready. Am I standards met? And if I'm not, okay, what steps do I need to take to ensure that I am? And then it's an annual review of the information that's held. And it goes in that spreadsheet in terms of preparation.
Absolutely. I think it's a good tip, and if you're not familiar with that, kind of start to look at that. That seems like a good one of the good places to start, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there is support available. Again, lots of the care associations offer support to assist people to become standards met under DSPT.
And there's a new e-learning training as well that people can access for free. So we'll make sure we link to that in the show notes. I wanted to ask you a little bit about one of the things I noticed on the CQC website is that there's much well I think is much clearer in terms of best practice, best guidance, and I wondered, well, maybe not, maybe you don't think it's quite clear, but I think it's easy to see, what's for all sectors, what's for some sectors, what's for, specialized sectors in terms of best practice. What are the things do you think, from a legal perspective, that people need to be aware of when looking at best practice or best guidance?
Okay, so on the CQC website, there is now evidence categories for sector groups. And so what that does is it lists specifically the evidence categories that CQC will be looking at when they come to assess by provider type. And that is certainly very useful for ensuring that your preparation work is focused for your sector type. That can be now found under the guidance and regulation providers and then assessment tab, and it's all the way at the bottom of the page. So, for example, there's one for care homes and supported living, and there's one for home care and shared life services. Inside each of those evidence categories for sector groups are the five key questions that we all know and love. And underneath each of those are the evidence category types that CQC will be looking at per quality statement. So it is laid out clearly, if a little hard to find in the first instance. In terms of the best practice guidance is not at that level. The best practice guidance is only at the level currently, and we don't know whether this is going to be developed by CQC further, of the five key questions at the overarching level. And so when you look at the best practice guidance, whilst it's really useful to have it there, and there's lots of great links and great information, for example, to the DSPT that we were just talking about, there's links to that, Oliver McGowan training and so on. They represent an opportunity. They also represent a piece of work that each provider will need to do, because they need to go through the best practice guidance and figure out which pertain to their actual service. Because quite a lot of it is NHS guidance, which may or may not apply to the setting.
No, I see what you're saying. So you kind of almost need to take that guidance. So if you think about NICE guidance, for instance, for medication, you kind of need to go in and go, okay, well, that links to the quality statement about medication. And if I'm a care home, I need to find the guidance, the NICE guidance on medication for care homes. So you almost have to do a little bit of work yourself. You can't just go, oh, there's a link there and that's helpful, but I need, you kind of need to do that extra bit of work. So important to maybe kind of reflect and spend a bit of time on that. Because I suppose the thing with guidance like that, it almost sets the standard. This is what we're expecting, isn't it?
And CQC have actually used that language.
Right.
So, for example, under the safe key question, and then under medicines optimization quality statement, and indeed it says the same words under every quality statement. It says, we expect providers, commissioners, and system leaders to live up to this statement. And that's it pertaining to the quality statement.
Yeah.
And then in terms of the best practice guidance, which is at the bottom of each of the quality statement pages. It says we expect providers to be aware of and follow the following best practice guidance.
And
So it's
then
quite
there's a,
clear.
yeah, then there's
That
a,
is quite clear, isn't it?
yeah. Yeah, so you know, if you're not aware or if you haven't looked, because I think guidance changes, doesn't it? So it's about being aware of the latest guidance for those. Really, really interesting. And I think, you know, I think as we're saying introduction, you know, keep an eye on this. This is a moving picture. You know, we are, you know, March 2024, you know, things can change. You know, they're changing. They're just changing the last month, haven't they? So really kind of keep an eye on newsletters and read those really carefully, et cetera.
Yeah, there's lots of webinars available that people can look at. And the other thing I would guard against is printing out this from
Yeah.
anything from CQC's website. They've now taken to labeling pages with last significant update, which doesn't mean the last thing we changed. And so these pages are being changed all the time. They're being updated, slight tweaks. So if you were to print them out, you may leave yourself open to not realizing that something has been added or changed.
Yeah. Good
Really good
advice.
advice,
Yeah.
definitely good advice. So we always have our time to care slot in every episode. So we want to ask you the same question. What is your most time-saving tip?
So my most time-saving tip would be don't try and start each day thinking with of your to-do list. End the day before with your to-do list for the following day, so that when you arrive, you've already got the list because something else is going to happen. Social care is a world where you have a certain element of control about what you think you're going to do on each given day, but often the planets seem to align and give you a whole load of other things that you didn't realize you were going to have to do that day as well. And they will be adding to your to-do list. And it's okay that your to-do list is a running to-do list and that you get to reprioritize. And it really is reviewing, okay, well, what did I think I was going to do today? What's happening to me now? What must I do? And trying to become an effective delegator. So if you have those people in your organization that you've identified that would like to take on more responsibility, that would like to develop leadership skills. If there are things that would be appropriate to delegate to them to do, as long as you're giving them the support to then complete that task, once you become effective at delegating and they become confident in what you're asking them to do, you will find that suddenly your to-do list becomes different, broader. You are perhaps rather than doing the task, you're managing somebody else to do the task and supporting them to do it. And by the same token, then growing the skill set you have in your organization and making people feel more valued.
Yeah, I think that's a great tip. And
Yep.
probably a one that's good not just for time saving, but for your own mental well-being as well. Our final question is, imagine we're in a lift on the 10th floor going down with a group of registered managers, and before everyone gets out, you want to tell them what's your most important, your key message that you want to leave them with. So you've only got a really limited amount of time. What would be your key message?
Wow. 10 floors.
10
Yeah.
floors.
Okay.
Fast
It's
lift.
a, yeah,
Fast
fast
lift,
lift.
yeah.
Okay. I think the first thing is to say you've got this. And that would be where I would start. And I would probably end as the doors open by saying thank you, because I don't think people say thank you enough, because the job at a senior level in health and social care is a hard, hard job. And people don't often say thank you anymore. And for all the flaws I had in the middle, I would probably say take a pause and look at what you achieve, look at what you do. Don't just berate yourself for the things that you have not managed to complete today. Rather, look at what you have done today. Be your own and your service's best advocate. And it could be daunting, and that's all right. Don't try and do it all alone. And given that when CQC come, they are likely to require things of you electronically as well as in person, who is going to be that support for you on that day or those 3 days? Because you're likely going to need it because it's a new style of assessment. And don't take on that additional burden yourself. Think about it in advance. And ask for support. It's there. It's available.
Yeah, good advice. And I think people, as some managers do feel quite alone, don't they? So, that's a really good advice about, plan to get support. How are you going to get it? It could be another register manager if you haven't got anybody within your organisation, or depending on your setup. So that's really good advice. Thank you so much. Fascinating conversation, and I knew this would be really interesting, and it was. So thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks enough. Bye.
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 Oh, that was a really good in conversation with Isabel there, Wendy. What do you think?
She had so many interesting things to say, didn't she?
Yeah, must be really interesting for her to kind of see everything from the other side. I just thought her perception of things around CQC and how she's seeing that now is, I think, was really, really interesting. The other thing that really sort of struck me was about, I suppose, having stepped away from social care or working directly in social care, she's kind of seeing the importance of being part of the sort of system in where you are, connecting with health, with local authorities, with integrated care board colleagues, all those things. And she's suddenly seeing all the importance of that and how each care provider is sort of kind of an important piece. It's really, I just thought it was really interesting. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's the world is changing so quickly in social care at the moment, and I think it's hard sometimes for registered managers to keep up with that.
Yeah. And also to understand, because I think, yes, the changes were last year, in 2023, but it can be really complicated. So Skills for Care has produced, well, we have a website, a web page, which has a lot of information about the sort of changes. There's a quite a good little film. It's 2 minutes long. Just is what is an ICS? Just kind of explaining how do we all fit into this. And there's lots of other information on the web page that's worth having a look at. If it's something you're sort of thinking, gosh, I don't know anything about this, or I would, like to know a bit more about how I can get involved, have a look at the film and the other information on the web page.
Yeah, I thought it was really important what she was also saying about the importance of CQC looking at digital records, and that historically we've done everything on a paper-based system, but CQC are increasingly looking at recording and other sort of digital innovations. And I was thinking about the Digital Care Hub, which is really the go-to place for all social care providers. Who are wanting to think about, what changes that they could make around that digital work. But I was also thinking about some of the webinars that we've done at Skills for Care. It's really challenging for some managers who maybe have been around for a while and haven't, started at a time when digital wasn't really a thing. And I was thinking about the recorded webinar that we had that was titled, "I'm a Technophobe, Get Me Out of Here."
Great title.
It's a good, yeah, great title, Taking the Fear Out of Digital for Social Care Managers. And we've also got another one on change management, which is sharing lessons and learning from managers leading digital change in their services.
Yeah, I think both You know, wherever you are in that digital journey, and you know, I speak to lots of managers who are in very different places. You know, some are, you know, are still using paper. Some are, you know, have started the process, and some have been using VM. Whatever you are, it's definitely worth connecting both with those webinars, but also to Digital Care Hub, because the Digital Care Hub, as you say, they, you know, if you need to know something, that's the place to go. They have so many good information toolkits, webinars. E-training, you know, e-learning training. So there's so much information that's worth being aware of. The other thing that really sort of kind of struck me when she was talking about the changes was about learning from each other and really using register manager peers in the register manager network. So it's sort of kind of the ideal place to do that, both in terms of integration, but also in terms of the changes to CQC, you know, meeting other managers, talking about what's happening. And even when if you are having tricky issues, you know, difficulties with accessing something or not understanding some of the changes, having those networks, being able to meet with them and talk to other managers. It's you know, vital, I think, in this very changing world of social care at the moment. So that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for joining us. And remember, all the resources that we talked about today will be in the show notes and on the website. And bye for now.
Bye.